Nelson's design innovations include the concept of the pedestrian mall, which he formulated in 1942, and the storage wall unit, which he first created in 1943. The design show features several examples of his bubble lamps and his sling sofa. In 1959, Nelson designed the American exhibition in Moscow for the United States Information Agency. He designed the Chrysler exhibit and the Irish Pavilion for the 1964 New York World's Fair. Nelson was an editor of Architectural Forum from 1935 to 1944. Since 1946, he's been affiliated with Herman Miller. He was the first design director for this prestigious firm. In 1979, Nelson won the Medal of Honor from the New York chapter of the American Institute of Architects. He lives in New York, and the design exhibit opens Sunday at the Philadelphia Museum of Art. It continues through January 8th. There will be several guest speakers who will be speaking on subjects raised by this show. For more information about the show and guest speakers, you can call the Philadelphia Museum of Art at 787-5431. That's 787-5431. George Nelson, welcome to Fresh Air. The kinds of objects that you have in this show, furniture, appliances, dishware, are the kinds of things you can go see in stores, in furniture stores and, home stores. What's the difference between the museum treatment and the store treatment of furniture, appliances, dishware?
Well, that's a very interesting question. In fact, we thought about that while we were designing the show. A store has certain pressures on it. One is that it must use every square foot of space as economically, as profitably as it can. So store windows, for instance, contain three times as much merchandise as you would imagine they could cram in there. Not all stores, but appliance stores do that. And one way you can tell you're in a museum and not a store is that in a museum you waste a lot of space. See, you give an object on display some air around it. And it's quite true that as you go through there, the game that everybody plays is, oh, we have one of those, or don't the Whoosits have one, or I wish that I had a brown coffee grinder, whatever it is they're looking at. So there's the fun of relating. This is not like an art show, where you don't think, gee, I wish I had a Picasso. Aunt Mamie has a Picasso just like that. It's something quite, it's much more immediate.
One of the things I enjoyed about the show was not having any store pressure there. When you're in a store, you're expected to buy. And say you are there to buy, then you have to make a choice. You can't like seven things equally. You have to narrow it down to one that you're going to spend your money on. And it's wonderful to look at these objects without any of the pressure associated with shopping and salespeople.
Oh, sure. Well, that's also a store in theory will show anything that it can sell. I mean, stores certainly discriminate their merchandise. But generally speaking, if you can sell it, you show it. And museums don't have that pressure on them either. They can show something that was made in an edition of one, which somebody thinks is very crazy or funny or beautiful, and they show it. So you get a different atmosphere in a museum, naturally.
You get a different view of things when you have, like, a whole line of some of the best design lamps, that designers from around the world have done in the last 30 years. What are some of the things that you began to notice putting together the show that you hadn't thought about before until the collection was assembled?
Well, you think about an awful lot of things. For instance, the title of the show says Design Since 1945. So one of the questions is, what do you mean by design anyway? A big Boeing, for instance, is a design, beautiful design, very marvelous. It usually goes up and flies and comes down and doesn't kill everybody. Wonderful designs. But you don't put that in a show, and you don't put a model of it in a show because you see it in every travel agency window. So you say, well, no, we don't mean Boeings. Well, do you mean army tanks? No, we don't mean army tanks. Do you mean the Brooklyn Bridge or something? No, that's design, but that's engineering design. So pretty soon, by the time you've excluded about 99% of what is designed in the modern world, you end up, in this case, as in others, with objects that are used in the home or in the workplace, in the office. So everything gets to be small-scale stuff.
Social trends, I think, have a pretty profound effect on how things are designed, both for their function and also their look. You started working with the Herman Miller firm just at about the time the war ended.
Yes.
Did the Second World War, which is just the time that this exhibit starts, have an effect on the materials that were used in design or the form of what was designed?
I can't think of anything specific. What went on during the war was that nobody could get anything. You know, they were making it all into bullets or whatever they were making. So there was a tremendous pent-up desire for all kinds of things that had worn out or whatever. So it was after the war ended that you suddenly got this real launching of all kinds of new stuff in a great big hurry.
Did the lack of materials affect your early work?
Well, I wasn't being a designer until after the war. And my earlier work had been in architecture, and of course that got terminated by the war, maybe fortunately, who knows. And then I passed the time in a very interesting way working for a magazine, an architectural magazine that at that time belonged to Time Life. And that was lovely. And of course paper, there was always enough paper to make a new issue of the magazine. So in a sense, we weren't actively disturbed by shortages.
You've designed several lines of office furniture. I think the first one you designed was in the 1940s, wasn't it?
Yes, it was.
What was the state of the art of the typical office at the time you designed that first line?
The typical office at that time was a desk and a work table. Sometimes the owner of the desk sat in a swivel chair and he worked at the desk. And then he swung around and he worked on the work table. And usually they had a few wooden files, and that was about it. And it was a marvelous office, really, much better than these complex systems we have at the moment. And then people who were up in the hierarchy often had roll-top desks, which at one point got to be the symbol of the outdoor worn, the old-fashioned, and so on. Then later came back because a roll-top desk is a marvelous way to hide the mess, you know. So there wasn't much thought at that point about designing anything for the office. You'd go to a furniture store and you'd buy something. And the chairs could be swiveled and you could raise them up and down to adjust the height. And very little of the fancy stuff that has happened since.
Can you describe some of the things that you designed for office use?
Well,
the concepts that you developed for the office.
Well, the first thing we did was called Executive Office Group. And basically this consisted of a table, a work table, that was in front of you, and a row of low storage boxes to the side. And then one of the boxes was at the proper height for holding a typewriter. So, say, a secretary could turn in her chair and type something on the old IBM or whatever. And that's where the storage was kept. And that was really the first time that the basic traditional desk got diddled with, because the basic desk had a top, a knee hole, and two stacks of drawers on either side of your knees. And all desks looked like that. We just took the drawers out and put them nearby.
And you developed the L-shaped desk too, didn't you?
That was the L-shaped desk. See, the desk was in front and then the storage made the L.
What do you think of the modern office now? There's two kinds I have in mind. One is the executive office with the high swivel chair and the desk, and then the other's the open. I forget what what the word is to describe it, but you have many offices with partitions as opposed to enclosed offices in a large space.
Oh, I think they're very good for non-people. Bureaucrats, zombies, whatever. I don't think they're a place where anybody would willingly spend 8 hours a day if he could avoid it.
You think the enclosed offices are better?
Well, it isn't necessarily the enclosed or the unenclosed, but you look at these rabbit warrens where people all have these little cubicles with screens that go up 6 feet or whatever, and it's really like being a slot in the post office. And they're not very private. Noise comes over the top and so on. No, I think people work in them because they've got to eat. I don't think they go there because of some sense of great joy in what they're doing.
In one of the offices that you were designing, you distributed to everybody individual lamps that could be not only turned on or off individually, but directed at the source that you needed
yeah,
light for.
Yeah, but that was just something we'd been doing at home for years. The notion that you have a lamp on your desk, leaving out the room lighting, which you need so you don't trip over the furniture. But the notion that you have a lamp that's adjustable so you can put the light where you want it is hardly earth-shaking. You know, they just didn't happen to be doing it. The lamps were available. You could buy them.
But it sounded like it had a pretty dramatic effect on the people who worked in the offices.
Oh, it was unbelievable, the effect it had when we first put these lamps in a test area in an insurance company. The people were very excited because, and we were a little baffled because they weren't crazy. You know, here they were getting all foamed up, you know, like a glass of beer over these lamps that they could push around. And it occurred to me that probably what got them excited was the first time in their working lives they had something they could control. In other words, you could talk to this lamp and say, look, I don't want you over there. I want you shining on my piece of paper here. And the lamp wouldn't talk back, you know. You just tap it and it would move over. This was a big thrill to these people.
So control is a pretty important part of making a good office environment.
Control is terribly important. Do you know anybody who enjoys any situation where they feel out of control? You know, it's a little rough. And the great envy of the boss in the corporate hierarchy is control. I mean, they like his salary or something, but it's control. He's in a closed office. He has a door that can be shut. If he's inside putting on his knee-deep carpet, he's got a dragon outside the door at another desk who says, I'm sorry, but Mr. So-and-so is in conference, you know, or whatever he's supposed to be doing. And he can set up everything to be exact, at least that's the image of him, the way he wants. So naturally, all the symbols of rising in the corporate hierarchy have something to do with control or identity, because modern people suffer from an almost total lack of identity.
In one of your books, you make the statement that people who enjoy their jobs tend to have sloppy desks and people who don't tend to have neater desks. Did you do research for that, or is that just a general observation?
You just look around. For instance, you go to a standard corporate office done by a very good firm of architects and designers, and everything is lined up in a row, you know, like some little toy soldiers on parade. You go to a place like, say, Stanford Research on the West Coast, which is full of these brainy guys who are doing exactly what they want to do, and these places are rat's nests. You know, three or four computers lying around, papers piled up on the floor and on the chairs and so on. No, these are the offices of people who are really enjoying what they're doing. But bureaucrats, by and large, don't enjoy what they're doing unless they're very, very low-pressure people.
My guest is designer George Nelson. If you're just joining us, has also written several books and taught as well. He conceived the show at the Philadelphia Museum of Art that opens on Sunday, which is a show of design since 1945, featuring furniture, dishware, appliances, textiles, and lighting. Let's talk about another concept that you developed, which was the pedestrian mall. Your first name for it was Grass on Main Street. How did you come up with that name?
Well, this was during that great election battle between Mr. Hoover, who I think was up for re-election. It was right at the bottom of the Depression. And Mr. Roosevelt, who was up to displace Mr. Hoover. And Roosevelt was promising all kinds of things that people thought were pretty radical. As we look back, they were really quite mild and conservative. But Hoover made a remark that struck me very forcibly. Hoover said, if you elect this terrible parlor pink radical from Hyde Park, New York, whatever it is, grass is going to grow on Main Street, as if to say the whole economy would really collapse. Well, I live in New York. And no, grass was going to grow in Times Square. That was what he said. I think it was a local speech. Well, I was in Times Square off and on. You'd go to the theater or something like that. And suddenly I had this vision of Times Square, you know, with grass all over it. And maybe a cow or two. And I thought, my God, what a beautiful thought. All these smelly cars and all that noise getting out. And not being terribly political, I went right out and voted for Roosevelt. And, of course, Mr. Roosevelt did not cause grass to grow in Times Square because it was Hoover who promised, not Roosevelt. But, and then a couple of years later, I was given some work to do that had to do with center cities. In other words, I was working with air views looking down at the business section of a series of towns of, say, 150 or 200,000 people. And in those days, everybody was talking about the ring of blight which surrounded the center of the city. And the ring of blight was where the rich folk had had their houses and so on, and they'd walk so they could walk to work, the judges, the lawyers, the doctors, the merchants, and all that. And they had iron deer on the lawn and columns and railings and all that. Then, of course, as the city center grew, these people who could afford to moved out somewhat to the suburbs or farther away from the center. And their houses became white elephants. Nobody knew what to do with these things. So they got to be Chinese laundries or automobile repair shops in sort of a slum. And so this was the ring of blight, you see, that surrounded the middle of town. Well, I was looking at these maps, these air maps, and you could see this ring of blight. Indeed, it was there. And suddenly a really crazy idea crossed my mind, and that was, what if you acted like a dentist, you know, cleaning out a cavity in a tooth, and you just scraped out this ring of blight, what would you be left with? Well, the first thing I realized you'd be left with was a ring road around the center section of the town. Then I got very excited and rushed out and got measuring instruments so that I could measure the length of the streets in the center, and realized they were all walkable, 6-8 blocks, and there was one main street and a couple of shopping streets. And I suddenly realized that this whole thing inside the old ring of blight could be pedestrian, with provisions, you know, for police, ambulance, truck, garbage, and all that. And then, of course, in this area of the ring of blight, you could put up all the parking garages or parking areas you wanted. So somebody came along at this moment, and the next thing I knew, we were publishing a proposal in the Saturday Evening Post that this is what should happen to the post-war American city of medium size. And it was called Grass on Main Street because this was exactly what we planned to do. Saturday Evening Post in those days was a very big weekly magazine. They claimed 7 million readers, which in, say, 1940 was a very large audience. And this thing was a two-page presentation, which was very generous. And I think I got one letter out of their 7 million readers. And I realized later that this happened just before the war was over. The last thing people were wondering about at that point was whether to plant grass on Main Street or not. They were wondering about whether their family was coming home and whether the kids were not, you know, were going to survive and all of that. So the timing couldn't have been worse.
What do you think of the way pedestrian malls are being realized now?
Well, there's some beauties in the world. There's one in Munich that's absolutely sensational. Must be a mile and a half total of pedestrian areas. And Copenhagen has got a lot of these things. Even Aspen, Colorado has got two little streets that have been made into pedestrian things. And whenever you do it, people respond in a very happy way. They like the benches and the trees and not having to look over their shoulders to see if a car is going to run them down. So the pedestrian mall is here to stay, there's no doubt about it. And some places you can use it, and other places it's not expedient to do it.
Have you had the chance to build any yourself? To design any?
No, I just had the idea and promoted it, and other people developed it. Because there was about a 10-year gap between the proposal and a situation arising where a group of architects was able to make a serious proposal to a city. As I say, my timing was terrible.
George Nelson, designer, is my guest, and he conceived the idea for the design show that opens Sunday at the Philadelphia Museum of Art. There are always brilliant designs in furniture and appliances and so forth being created, and at the same time, there's always real tacky, ugly, clumsy-looking things being designed as well. When say, take the 1950s, for instance. How aware were you of the clumsy, ugly, cheap, tacky stuff being designed? Do you make a point of knowing that? Or I don't, maybe you can't even help, but
that was
but
what
we
all lived
it.
With. That's what our parents' houses were like. But you see, we viewed it differently. It was clumsy, tacky, whatnot stuff, but it was comfortable. And we'd grown up there, and we did our homework at the dining room table, and they had Morris chairs and things. So our memories of these tacky homes, for many of us, were very warm and pleasant. And later we thought, well, our parents were a little stuffy and backwards, and we got a bit snooty, and why didn't they have furniture like you can see at the museum show? But as I look back, those tacky houses we were brought up in were very okay to live in.
Did you grow up in a family where there were slip covers on the good furniture?
There was that.
Or plastic covers on the furniture,
too.
No,
there weren't any plastics. You see, I'm older than you think. There were things like oilcloth, but that was about as or celluloid. That's about as close as you got to plastics. No, I'm strictly a pre-plastic kid. And
how have you designed your own home?
Never designed it much, really.
Well, the interior.
Well, you sort of put things in where you need it. I don't think designers, unless they're in the business of creating a showroom for themselves, do much design. They simply... you know, sometimes we say design is for the clients. You know, we don't need it. And no, you get things you like. And my wife and I would get terribly enthusiastic about this table or that chair or that lamp or something. So gradually you accumulated a number of things. But at that time, you know, because we weren't feeling very doctrinaire about this, we also had old stuff. There were Tiffany lamps around that we felt perfectly good with. We didn't see why they should be thrown out because they stopped being stylish for 10 or 15 years. And really what you were after was a place where you could be comfortable, that was all. Most houses, most interiors, at least in the middle class generally, are really done to assuage terrible feelings of personal insecurity. And they're all, they're real keeping up with the Joneses exercises. And if somebody down the block has a something, you know, the housewives kind of worry until they can do something. The notion that the home is yours and you should damn well do with it what suits you is something the great majority of people are much too scared to even think about, or they want decorators to tell them what's correct. So they're constantly, it's like their grandmothers who are always putting on corsets that drove them crazy, you know, because they were so tightly laced. And there's a great, and of course the home decorating magazines raise this nervousness about what kind of image your home is giving to a point of real, you know, mass neurosis. Very silly business.
There are always ads, I think there's less of them now, for furniture waxes so that you can get the kind of shine where you could see yourself in it.
Oh, my God, all those TV commercials now. There's something now, some kind of cleaner, that removes all the dirt or whatever it is, the oil spill from the last cargo ship that cracked up. You know, from the floor, so that the shine comes through. I've never owned a floor that had a shine that came through. It was always something you applied to the thing. But at any rate, this new cleaner I have visions of this stuff being applied to a rough brick floor, you know, and you clean it and the shine of the rough brick floor comes through. But anyway.
You said that you remember the homes that we might think of as tacky as being awfully comfortable. Do you think that that really state-of-the-art designs, the kind of internationally celebrated furniture designs, should be really comfortable too?
Well, anything should be comfortable. Why? I mean, if you're going to sit in a piece of furniture, you might as well not have it assassinate you. Unless, of course, you're a confirmed masochist and you don't want to sit on anything if you don't suffer a little bit. I don't think there are many people in that category. Most people, if they sit down, would like something that would receive them in a friendly manner, you know.
Have you tried out all the chairs in the design
show? Yeah, I have. That's been sort of interesting. Although I'm in the business, I'd never sat in that many different makes of chairs at once. And as usual, anybody with any kind of figure at all, young, old, big, or whatever, tends to home in on one or another of these chairs, which seems more comfortable. And this is a pretty tricky decision to make, because what you think isn't really necessarily, you know, the best chair as far as reducing fatigue or something like that. But the best way to be comfortable in a chair is to work in it until you're uncomfortable, and then you get up and stretch and walk around. You don't need all this machinery.
Do you think that designer's idea of what makes a comfortable chair has changed since 1945?
I have no idea. I have no idea at all. It's gotten very high-tech. You know, they have all kinds of gas cylinders and handles to make things happen. But we belong to a generation that believes if there isn't a button to push, it's no good.
But I think in the past it used to be if it isn't really like plush and soft, big plush and soft, it isn't comfortable.
Well, it's always the prevailing belief. When my father and mother went shopping for a set of dining room furniture, I remember when I was a little child, my mother, who was supposed to have the taste, because in America women are supposed to have taste, God knows what men have. And maybe checkbooks. And, you know, she would find something she liked, and then my father would try to heft it, you know. And what happened was if he couldn't lift it, he approved it.
That's great.
Yeah, because it meant solid construction and so on. So Mama would use her taste, which, as I look back, was non-existent, And Papa would use his muscles, which were not that great. And if he couldn't lift it, then we bought it.
So you had heavy, ugly furniture.
Yeah. I don't know how ugly it was. Ugliness is in the eye of the beholder.
Do you shop for furniture in stores? Or
never. Yeah. Why would I do that? We've got too much furniture. We got enough furniture for the rest of our lives and a few more.
So you never get to partake in that really neurotic experience of going to department store showrooms and
looking
around.
You can be thoroughly neurotic without going near a department store. It's no problem.
One of the chairs in the Philadelphia Museum of Art exhibit is chrome steel that's enameled, and it looks like it's taken from a tractor seat.
Yeah, yeah.
Is it borrowed from that?
It is taken from a tractor seat.
Is it comfortable? There's no back on it. What would you use it for?
Stool. No, that was done by one of the most brilliant of the Italian designers. And you could just see this happening. You know, they were sitting around a cafe table talking about furniture, and somebody said, you know, those tractors that the farmers have with a perforated sheet, those look like damn comfortable things to sit on, you know? So the next thing you know, this guy goes out and has somebody make a base for it, and it gets worldwide publicity because nobody ever thought of using a tractor seat to sit in before. This is known as a transfer from the work area to the high fashion area. But tractor seat is a very pretty thing. You know, it's a nice organic shape, and you got all these holes in it, which give it a lighter look. It's very pretty. It's just good to sit in as anything else.
One of your couches is on exhibit.
Oh,
yeah. And it's a sling couch. Would you describe the concept?
Well, it's a chromium-plated tube structure with rubber bands holding up the cushions. And it's very comfortable. And what else? It's very expensive, too. I think you could buy a new small car for what this thing costs.
You know the egg chairs, the egg-shaped chairs?
That thing that you sort of could live in?
Yeah, like that, half an igloo.
Yeah.
I used to think, gee, those looked awfully comfortable. And now I think, gee, they look uncomfortable because my idea of what makes a comfortable chair has changed. Now I think of, like, firm back support that supports your lower back with a fairly hard bottom that, so your feet touch the floor. I think of that as being comfortable.
Well, your ideas of what's comfortable change tremendously as you get older. And by getting older, I mean older than, say, 16 or 18. That's when it begins to change. You watch a bunch of teenage kids coming into a party, and very gracefully they'll all sit on the floor and get in all sorts of relaxed positions. And they're good for all night, you know. Why? Because they have these young bodies that are in very good shape. You get to my age, and practically everything is a problem. You know, what you sit on, whether you can get up out of it comfortably, and so on. And then in between, there are all these ages when your body is not quite sensing comfort in the way it did 5 years ago. So one has to be prepared for changes in one's body judgment of what is or is not comfortable. That's quite normal.
George Nelson is my guest, and he conceived the show which opens Sunday at the Philadelphia Museum of Art, which is called Design Since 1945. Do you think that there is still a strong legacy of the Bauhaus that's surviving a contemporary design?
Well, Bauhaus has gotten to mean a kind of look. And you generally think of Breuer's springy chairs, you know, the bent chrome-plated tubes and so on. Bauhaus was, as an idea, was really quite another matter, which was a matter of developing designs that fit in some consistent way into the way the world is. Like if the world is not full of Duncan Fifes who will make you, you know, dining rooms, suits of furniture to order in his Philadelphia cabinet shop. But, you know, it's made in factories. Then things like industrial materials get to be perfectly okay for furniture. And the Bauhaus merely moved this to the point where people understood that this was what they stood for. Since then, of course, it's been turned into an ideology. And Tom Wolfe, for instance, wrote one of his few truly idiotic books about this. And so Bauhaus simply represents a set of events and developing attitudes at a moment, many of which are still perfectly good.
I'm going to quote something that you've said. You've said that in design problem solving, in design problem solving, the limitations are far more important than the freedoms. How does that apply to your work?
Well, it applies to anybody's work. Absolutely anybody's. I once played a game. It went something like this. I imagine the ideal client comes to my young architect's office, say, and says, I want you to design me a house. And you say, well, what kind of house? A family house or individual? How many children do you have? You know, are you and your wife still staying together? You know, and all of that. And this imaginary client says, look, I don't want to do anything to interfere with your creativity. I can't tell you how many bedrooms or bathrooms or anything. So you think, my goodness, you know, what do I design this house with? I don't know how many bedrooms. And you say, well, have you got a site for this house? Like, is it in a city or is it on the beach or is it north or is it in the Sun Belt or up in the mountains? And again, you get this same answer. You see, I want you to have perfect liberty. You cannot design this house for any site. That would limit your creativity. Well, you're in an utterly idiotic situation. The architect can't even draw the first line. Well, why can't he draw the first line? Because he can't draw the line until he's got some limitations. Like if the man said, I want 3 bedrooms, now he can draw. Because he's saying, I don't want 2 bedrooms, I don't want 4 bedrooms, I want 3 bedrooms. Well, you can start making a plan with this. No, limitations are everything.
Is that how you usually work with a client, that you find out what their problems are and what their needs
are? It helps if you want him to get something that he won't sue you for. You know, really, costs a lot of money to get a house designed and built, and it's reasonable for the customer to expect that it'll have some connection with what he is after. You know, that's not unfair. Clients don't give architects money to express themselves. That's a progressive kindergarten idea.
Have you ever been, you've been affiliated with Herman Miller for many years, but have you ever been approached by a very commercial house that would really like mass reproduce something for a lot less? Is that something you would ever consider doing? What are the concerns of a designer?
Oh, sure. A designer will consider anything that has a fee attached to it.
Is there ever any concern that at a certain point the mass production will become shoddy and won't do justice to the design?
Well, anything can become shoddy. Mass production can be exquisitely beautiful and so on. There's no connection between mass production and quality or shoddiness. All mass production is mass production. For instance, the Japanese cars, which are apparently greatly liked by buyers, are mass production cars, even more mass production than the American cars. The American cars have been relatively unpopular with some of their markets because the doors make a funny noise when they shut and the dashboards are full of fake woods made out of plastic and all of that jazz. But they're mass production cars too. So if you like to buy a really expensive good car and you get a Mercedes, that is a high production car. So mass production is a word which simply means you make a lot of something.
What do you look for to be certain that your design will be reproduced with quality?
Well, you find out if this company is accustomed to making things with quality. There's no way you can write a contract, you know, where you can have a lawsuit and say, they didn't make my thing with quality. You know, you'd be laughed out of court. because everything has quality. It's just that their idea of quality is different from yours. So when I was sort of brought up with Herman Miller, they're our oldest client, and their ideas of quality always struck me as just fine. In fact, they would sometimes bend over backwards to get good. As a result, you look at 30-year-old Herman Miller pieces, and they're still, the drawer is still open without binding and so on. And there are other companies like that who care very much. So it really, this is a myth that mass production in some way cheapens things. It's only the people in the society that cheapen the society. Yeah.
There are technological innovations that have had an incredible effect on design, and I guess I'm thinking especially of like streamlining, which was the influence of planes, I guess, more specifically jet planes. The stuff from, I guess, the 40s, like refrigerators and appliances, had this really bulbous look. And then sometime in maybe the early 60s, they started slimming down.
But this is the thing you have to understand. You see, design is not logical. At least it isn't totally logical. You can see in museums medieval boxes, 12th century boxes, that have ornament on them that look like the front doors of a cathedral, pointed arches and all that kind of thing. In every period, minor arts copy the big time arts, always. So you might say that for the Middle Ages, the cathedral was the master design. Now for us, the airplane and the rocket are two designs that everybody looks up to. These are the Joneses, you see, that we want to keep up with. So one of the things that went on with cars when they were bulbous was they were reflecting the shapes of propeller-driven planes, all of which have soft, fat, leading edges, and then they taper back to a sharp edge behind. Well, what Detroit felt and the customers felt is if the DC-3, you know, has this kind of plump powder pigeon look, then how could we make a mistake by not doing the same thing? So the over-streamlined cars were really children of, aspiring, illegitimate children of the airplane industry. However, in the 50s, when the jets came in, a very funny thing happened, because the engineers discovered practically immediately that if you go at jets high subsonic speeds, say 500 miles, 550 miles an hour, the streamlining is an obstacle. It's aerodynamically no longer workable, and they began to get knife edges on the front wings of the jets, you see, which gave a very, very different look to the thing. Well, within a very short time, the cars were beginning to do the same thing. The tail fins, which were a special kind of extravagance that we associate with some of the cars of that period, were, of course, inspired by rockets and jet warplane shapes, which is normal. Those were the glamorous things, you see. It's like that story about John Wayne in one of his movies wore his belt with a buckle a little bit to the left or the right. It just was an accident, you know, he didn't center it. And then apparently in every drugstore across the United States, suddenly these little teenage cowboys, you know, were wearing their belts with the buckles off center. It's exactly like that.
What do you think? What designs or technology do you think is exerting a similar influence now on design?
Well, the electronic thing is very vigorous, because everything we knew that everything had a size. Like, say, a television set had a size, a radio had a size, or whatever. Suddenly we're finding these things are shrinking, 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 shrinking. You finally get down to things like the Sony Walkmans, which are really very high-quality listening gadgets, as far as I can make out, which have, and the other day, passing one of these stores, I saw my first wristwatch radio well, that may be all over creation. But here's a little wristwatch, which looks like a wristwatch. It's also a radio, and you can plug a pair of headphones into this thing, and so on. There are these new portable television things, which are minute, you know. They're the size of a small package of cigars. So this is one of the big things that, and now the computer is beginning to get it. They're talking about lap size computers that will have certain possibilities that people will like. All this is because they can get more and more and more stuff on a chip.
I don't know if you've seen the boxes for USA Today newspapers, but they're kind of rounded as if it's a TV screen or the screen of a word processor, whereas the newspaper boxes were usually just regular boxes that you'd open up. I don't know if they have them in New York.
You mean the vending machines? Oh, yeah, you put in a quarter or whatever it is, and out comes the paper, sure. Well, you see, there's another thing that happens with all designs, and that is designs must reflect the way they're made or the material they're made out of. One of the inexpensive way to make a good box is to bend it on a machine, on a tool they call a brake. And you get a very sharp bend, and then you weld the different parts together. So you get this box which has sharp corners and sharp edges. Well, sometimes this isn't such a good idea, because if anybody stumbled and hit one of these sharp edges or corners, he could very well slice his head in half, you know. So this is one of the reasons you might round corners and edges on things that are exposed to a lot of people and to possible accidents. And the technique you use for making round edges and corners is somewhat different from what you use, but it's perfectly feasible. Any sheet metal factory can do this for you. There's also a moment when sharp looks snappier than curved, like this story about the jets affecting the look of cars. Now cars are all being, most of the companies run cars through wind tunnels, because the better the aerodynamic design of the car is, the less fuel it uses. And of course, everybody's in this economy race. So cars are also taking on a real aerodynamic look, which is quite different from the emulating the fast planes. This is real. They can check it in a wind tunnel, and they can tell you very closely how close this is to ideal.
Do you have any aesthetic creed where, you know, you would officially like something who was designed for instance, the real rules, you know, that was designed because it really gave it better propulsion as opposed to copying the propulsive look of another object? Will you judge something about how its form follows its function, in other words?
Well, you always judge form and function. I mean, nobody can help that. You watch a pretty girl go down the street, and everybody is looking at form and function at the same time. And, you know, in this case, the form seems very well suited to function and so on. People respond to this.
You've said that you think that most people are pretty visually illiterate.
Oh, that's true of all modern technical societies, yes.
Why do you think that's true?
I have no idea. I think maybe there's too much to look at, so people don't look at anything, or they don't learn how to look at things and see anything.
You've once recommended using a camera to help you become visually
illiterate. Well, I use the camera a lot. It makes me look for certain things I wouldn't see otherwise. It's just a finder device, that's all.
One of my theories is that when we're young, we're taught that the word is important and pictures aren't.
In our society at this time, we're taught that, but in a somewhat more civilized society, this might not be the case. But then nobody accuses us of being civilized. I hope they should be in asylums.
The show that is now on exhibit, or on Sunday will be on exhibit at the Philadelphia Museum of Art, is, I think, a really exciting show. And I want to thank you for being here and for talking about the show and your own work. And is there any final comments you want to make about specifically the exhibit?
No, except that I'm happy the way it turned out. I mean, it did what we hoped it would do. And I don't know how good the Philadelphia people realize this museum is. Coming in as a foreigner all the way from New York, I can tell you it is an absolutely first-class institution, and working with the people there was really a joy, and I'm not being political because I may never come back, you know. I think they're one of the most stimulating and agreeable groups of people I've ever worked with. Very high-class stuff. So people in Philadelphia should go there to enjoy a top-quality experience, whether it's the show they're doing now or the wonderful collections. My son is spending the afternoon there crawling all over the medieval armor. He's a medieval armor freak.
You like medieval armor a lot, too.
Anybody likes. but he really likes it to the point of learning how it's made and so on. No, medieval armor is a superbly functional kind of thing, and the fact that it doesn't work anymore because anybody with a 22 pistol can put a has nothing to do with the fact that when it was done, it was really a stupendous achievement.
Well, it's been a great pleasure to have you here. Thanks a lot for visiting with us. And again, I want to tell you how much I enjoyed the show. George Nelson has been my guest. He's a designer and architect. And it was his idea to do this show at the Philadelphia Museum of Art. And he designed it along with people on the art museum staff. It opens on Sunday. And there are several guest speakers who will be coming to discuss design in conjunction with this exhibit. And rather than run through the whole schedule, what I'll do is give you a phone number you can call for more information at the museum. And that number is 787-5431. Again, 787-5431. The design exhibit opens on Sunday and continues at the Philadelphia Museum of Art through January 8th. And again, it includes furniture, appliances, lighting, textiles since World War II. And again, it's at the Philadelphia Museum of Art. And George Nelson, thanks again for being here.
Can I make one quick correction?
Yes.
It was not my idea to do the show. It was the museum's idea. And one should not deprive them of the credit that they're entitled to. We just designed it. They conceived of it.
Thank you for correcting me.
Right.
This is Fresh Air. You're tuned to WHYY-FM in Philadelphia, and it's 2 minutes to 4 o'clock. In just a few minutes on Fresh Air, we'll be joined by Laurie Anderson, and a retrospective of her work is about to open at the Institute of Contemporary Art in West Philadelphia on the University of Pennsylvania campus. Her work was, up until recently, known mostly by avant-garde artists and people who frequented the performance circuit. But she recorded something called Oh Superman, and it became quite a hit in England. It reached number 2 on the charts. To give you an idea of her work, let's listen to this popular recording, which also got her a contract on Warner Records. This is Laurie Anderson's Oh Superman. Ha, 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 ha.